Welcome to Following the Leftovers, the officially unofficial podcast for The Leftovers on HBO. I'm Jim.
And I'm Aaron.
And tonight we're covering Season 1, Episode 3, entitled Two Boats and a Helicopter. Do you know that joke, Aaron?
I do.
You do. Why don't you tell it for people who may not have caught it, and probably have heard it at some point, just don't remember it.
So the way I've always heard it is a man is a victim of a flood.
Yep.
And he climbs through the rooftop and he prays to God and he says, please, please, the floodwaters are about to overwhelm me. I need help. And a man in a boat rows by and he says, hey, jump in. I'll take you to safety. And the guy goes, no, thank you. I've prayed to God. Help is on the way.
Yep.
A guy in a motorboat comes by and says, seriously, the floodwaters are about to overwhelm you. You should jump in. And the guy goes, nope, I'm confident in my faith in God. He will provide, and I will wait on his grace. Lastly, a man in a helicopter sees him, and there's just like a foot of rooftop left. And he says, you're about to be overwhelmed. Let me throw down a ladder. I'm from the Coast Guard. I can take you to safety. The guy says, nope, I've prayed to God. Floodwaters overwhelms him. He dies. He goes to heaven at the pearly gates. He says, God, I don't understand, God. I prayed for you to help me. And God said, I sent two boats and a helicopter. What do you want?
Yeah.
Ba-dum-psh.
How do you think? So in that story, the guy has supreme faith, but it ultimately doesn't save him because he doesn't act on it. Or he doesn't act on the signs that are given him.
Yeah, he doesn't correctly interpret the signs.
In this episode, Matt does act. Matt acts fervently. Matt acts several times on these signs.
Yeah, but I think, okay, so here is my take on this.
Okay.
What's the Garvey at Keith? Is it no Kevin?
Kevin.
Kevin shows up. Dude, you just got your ass kicked.
Yeah.
You should stop doing your papers. Mm-hmm. It's time. Nope. Nope. I got to keep going. Keep it on.
Okay.
His sister says, Matt, you've lost your church. Mm-hmm. You're just. I used to support you. I love you, but you're just hurting yourself. You're doing no good. This isn't working. You need to stop.
Yeah.
My faith is strong. At the he gets his ass. I mean, he gets all this adversity,
mm-hmm.
and he just won't stop. And I feel like the end of the
episode,
he gets
the money taken from him. I feel is like the third sign of you're misinterpreting these signs.
Then he ends up losing the house anyway, which is either the floodwaters overwhelming him, or maybe that's the third sign. And now at the end is whether he's going to then is he going to stop? Is he going to double down? What is he going to do?
Yeah,
that's kind of my take. I also thought maybe the guilty remnant were representations of the other path he was supposed to take.
Like the man, they are the man on the roof?
They are.
I've heard that take as well.
Oh, really? Because I was more of that they are the rowboats, that they're trying to also tell him that you should stop. This is not the way to go.
Sure.
So
yeah. Everything is telling him to stop, and yet he seems convinced that he's doing the right thing and continuing.
And I can see why he would believe that.
Yeah, his crusade, I guess, makes a lot of sense to me. If you want to clear up misconceptions about these people, certainly you should probably get on the internet and do it. maybe not pass around flyers. That seems inefficient. But, you know, he's kind of doing the right thing if that's your idea of what this event meant.
And I feel like that's one of the weird plot holes in this film, that this guy, this kind of kook...
Mm-hmm.
And I use that term with affection because, again, I think he's got legitimate reasons to believe this, and I kind of weirdly believe in his quest. Like when he laid out to that pit boss what he's trying to do, which we'll probably get to a little bit more later, I'm like nodding. I'm like, I can't argue with that. That's a decent motivation. But I forget what I was saying.
Okay.
What was I trying to – point I was trying to make there?
Well, I kind of threw you into the deep end at the beginning of this episode.
Sure.
Maybe before we get too much farther into it, let's talk about our general thoughts about this episode, because this was a very different episode than we were shown for the first two of
the season. I want to also jump in here and say this is the first episode not directed by Peter Berg. This was directed by Keith Gordon.
Oh, okay.
Who's had a long and storied career.
Who is he? I've never heard of him.
He's directed an episode of The Strain.
Never saw it.
episode of the kill or episodes of the killing, Rubicon, mm-hmm. Dexter, House,
all right,
Walking Dead, Homicide: Life on the Streets. I mean, Miami Vice.
I would say that this might be his best work to date.
Well, it's hard to say because, you know, he's an actor.
Given the reputation of the shows you just listed me, and I've seen a lot of those shows, I would say that this show is shaping up to be better than any of those.
It's possible. It's possible.
And this episode in particular was my absolute favorite of the three we've seen.
I'm sure when he read this script, he was like, you know, there's some days you get out of bed and you're like really excited for what you're doing. And some days mm-hmm. you get out of bed and it's like, ugh, Glenn's got to go through this fucking tunnel. What?
Who's Dexter going to kill this week? Oh, Jesus. The baby's getting out of the bathtub.
But I feel like he got up with a spring in his step thinking, I'm going to sink my directorial teeth in this and shake it like a pit bull worrying a rope knot. I think, and also is written by a person who has experience on The Good Wife, which has a good reputation. I haven't seen it, and a lot of CSI type stuff. But you know, she also has a co credit with Damian Lindelof, which he has a writing credit for all these things. I'm kind of interested in whether that's just a vanity thing on his part or whether he actually did the Sorkin thing of I write the outlines for all the episodes, I ship it off to the writers to fill in the dialogue, and then they give it back and I Sorkinize it.
Man, I never felt like that was the approach they took in Lost when he was working with Cuse.
Mm-hmm.
And I would not be surprised if he is very involved in writing these scripts, even when he has a co-writer.
Okay. I mean, I would shock me either.
And this show feels very much like Damon Lindelof, certainly.
Right.
I don't think it's in exactly the same way that Lost felt like Damon Lindelof.
Right.
But I can see the Lindelof in this show. And I'm not opposed to that.
It's interesting that the ratings continue to drop for this. It started off at 1.77, which was a mild disappointment after some of the openings they've had with like True Detective and some other shows that have piloted.
Yeah.
It's lost about 250,000 viewers each week. It only had 1.4 million this week. I have no idea how that stacks up as far as HBO and whether, you know, this is going to be a standalone season and it won't be renewed or where they go from here.
Yeah.
But
personally, my journey with this show has been interesting. When I first saw it, I was like, oh, that's intriguing, but I've seen shows just like it.
Sure.
My second thought after seeing the preview 100 times was, please stop showing me this preview. I've seen it too many times.
I hear this song one more fucking time.
Yes. Seeing the first two episodes, they were good, but they weren't astounding. This is the episode where I've changed my mind. And I think the show is destined for greater things.
And it's funny because the show continues to polarize because I had about as many people said, you know, I was kind of interested in an intellectual way, but this episode really grabbed me by the nuts and I'm all in.
Yeah.
As people that said, you know, I can't believe they went to this crazy bottle episode with this weird Doctor Who guy. And I was kind of interested in the world, but if this is bullshit, I'm out. We've never covered a show this polarizing from the jump.
Absolutely. Along those lines, I was going to ask you, what do you think this episode does to the momentum that we had built from a worldview perspective in episodes 1 and 2?
That's a great question.
Specifically with Kevin, because I think Kevin's storyline was the most interesting coming out of episode 2. And that momentum to me has just completely flopped now.
I don't know that because, you know, you say momentum, but to me, I felt like they had some very clear questions. There weren't any cliffhangers.
I think the bagels are question raising at the very least.
I thought we were on the same page that those were question resolving.
I was also going to ask you that. Do you think this is a punctuation saying, okay, that part of Kevin's story is resolved? He is not crazy. Those bagels were actually there. The dog shooter was actually there.
I feel like this is the confident. This is Damon Lindelof saying, "I'm confident that I can throw the audience a curveball, and this episode is so good
It is.
And I also think that there's something to this theory that the Garvey family is tying all this together, because running through this whole thing is the relationship this guy had with the Garveys. In fact, that was the major plot point that kind of mechanically moved everything forward. The fact that his old man believed in him enough to leave him $20,000 that he could take at any time. We also dribbled off a little bit of plot. For example, his father, whose name escapes me, the Garvey, the eldest Garvey. We question whether he went crazy.
Might be Joe.
It doesn't matter. Sam, Max, Fred.
Let's keep going.
The eldest Garvey. We question whether he went crazy before or after the departure. It seems pretty clear that he went crazy after the departure.
Yeah, it seems like he was still the police chief after the departure.
And maybe he was part of the investigation to this corrupt judge, which seems like it was the very first case and we're surmising that this judge was the man driving the BMW that disappeared that caused his wife's car accident. And then the fact...
I think that's a stretch.
I don't think so. I think that they strongly imply. I mean, you could debate either way, and there's a really good take that we've got in our feedback section about that. But okay. I think you can debate. I think it's definitely the implication is there that because she said, you know, I've supported this when this is about the judge, and I understand you had to get through this, but now it's become this thing. Well, you know, judge, stereotypically lawyers drive BMWs, BMW slams into his wife, kills it. He finds out that this guy is actually some corrupt asshole, sets him off on this vengeance mission, this exposing, this separating the innocent from the guilty. I feel like that's, in my mind, that's settled.
So I'm wondering, I have a different vision of how this all went down in my head.
Share with me.
The idea, the notion that I get is that when this accident happened, when the departure happened, there was a fund set up, as we know, for the people who were departed, the people who disappeared on that day. And I don't know how far that program extends. Would it extend to giving benefits to the people who were injured as a result of that? And if that kind of case went to trial, could the judge have been bribed into saying, no, this does not, in fact, extend to the people who were injured because of people disappearing? And now he found out that judge took that bribe, Garvey busted him, left the money for him because he said, you deserve it, right? And I know that could be because the judge crashed into her. It could also be because the judge gave a ruling. To me,
or it could be
the implication that it's a judge says, like, there was some kind of ruling there. Not because it could have been anyone randomly in the car.
Certainly. And I feel like that's somehow more speculative than my take.
I don't think it's any more speculative or less.
Maybe you're right.
I think we just both have different ideas of what's going on here.
Sure. I feel like that his work to expose him exposed this judge's assets as being ill-gotten and as a result of bribes, and there's probably some forfeiture law, and the chief bent the rules and you know, gave
it, instead of that going into evidence, it went into
a coffee or a GIF can.
A creamy GIF can, yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's enough info to really say what the exact situation was, other than that money came from the corrupt judge.
But to fully answer your question, this episode was really moving to me.
Certainly.
In a very emotional way that I haven't really understood since, because I just finished watching a very entertaining True Blood episode that I was feeling very good and very happy. And this show, like, I started to feel weepy by the time we got to the opening. And I don't know, because I noticed...
just from him getting punched in the church?
Well,
By the way, I wish that guy had been MC Gainey. That's all I'm saying. It's one of the dudes from Lost, who is built just like that guy, essentially. Anyway.
The opening is what got me, because the one image of the angry father being held back and the boy praying in front of him. The first time I saw that, I kind of just washed over me. But I got this very clear impression that this boy was perhaps praying that God do something about his father. And I thought at the beginning that the boy was being raptured, whatever, and the father is angry about it, his family's. But now I got the fact that this is a violent man. And that this child, this small child, prayed for his father, for something to happen to his father, and now is left with that enormous amount of guilt, which we have some takes on feedback as well. And to me, I don't know. That just anytime I'm asked to put in the mental space of a child and try to grapple with adult things, I just get profoundly sad. And then the episode continued to hit them with his extensive flashback. I mean, I didn't. I wasn't a blubbering mess.
Are you talking about the actual intro?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. The actual
the painting. Yeah.
And I felt like I got progressively kind of sadder to the point, and I felt weepy. I didn't actually cry. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but that's what this show did to me, and that's one of the rare. I don't have that effect very often, and I kind of prize it. Like,
there is no doubt.
I'm the guy that when his grandmother died, I didn't cry, and I'm for days afterwards. I'm thinking, the fuck is wrong with me? Do I not have the capacity for grief? And finally, it hit me a couple days later. But that's my space. I'm like, Jesus, what? Why can't I feel? Is it healthy? And so when this stuff kind of happens naturally, So I'm saying that my relationship with this episode is not rational. I actually love it, and okay. I'm interested to see where they go from here.
I think from a rational perspective, you could also love this episode. I think it's a well-constructed episode, period. And the questions that it raises about faith and about what works are good, what works are bad, works here being a fairly biblical interpretation of that word. I think there are a lot of interesting questions there, and I hope we can discuss some of them in this podcast.
This is an episode that, beyond just being podcasters and getting all the details, really rewards even the casual fan of rewatching.
Sure.
Because there's extra layers of meaning. Like in the first scene, that guy's wife is sitting there in a wheelchair in the very front, and her caregiver's right there, and that's interesting. And then when he later has a conversation with Chief Garvey, and he says, you know, nights are tough for me. I took that on the initial watch as like, you know, nights are emotionally tough, emotionally difficult, which is certainly still there. But also, it's hard for me to get away from nights because I have this elaborate care routine I do with my wife every night for 3 years.
Yeah, yeah.
And that implication got a lump in my throat, too. The fact that this man has done this every day for years and was still with this degree of caring and love, that's almost superhuman.
Sure. This guy, I think, however you stack it, maybe up until the point that he potentially kills a man, is sympathetic in every possible way.
I mean, he's been tested with him beating that guy to death, too.
Hey, I'm not judging him for that.
Massive justice boner from this guy right here.
I actually might judge him positively for that.
Right.
Because the guy was clearly an asshole, and he deserves something. We don't know if he killed him. He might have killed him. He might not have. He gave him a beating.
I will say that it was another layer of sadness because it is a betrayal of who he is at his core.
That might also be part of what's going on here with him.
Sure.
You know, it's interesting that he does kind of sin there at the end. He gets this money that he's using $20,000 that has been wrongfully taken. Period. All around. I mean, it's a bribe money. It's wrongfully taken from the evidence room or whatever, we think.
Certainly. If it was on the up and up, it would not be buried underneath a barbecue.
Sure. Then he goes to a vice of gambling, which, you know, is borderline wrong.
Certainly many Christians find it a vice.
But I think it's the going overboard with that vice. I don't think it's placing the bet that's wrong. I think it's being addicted or... I don't know. It's up in the air. But then, you know, he has the money taken from him, which could be viewed as a sign from God.
Sure.
Like, you've done the wrong thing. Don't take this.
At least as powerful as pigeons on a red light.
Uh-huh. Interestingly, that green light turns immediately to a red light, no yellow.
Mm-hmm.
Those pigeons, that could also be taken as the sign to stop doing what you're doing.
Certainly.
Because it's wrong.
Right.
And on the table in the thing when the pigeons are just hanging out on that roulette table.
Yeah.
The guy yells Jesus fucking Christ right before it, which is a blasphemy.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a positive or negative sign for what he's doing?
Clearly,
the interpretation is open on all of these things.
And that's one of the brilliant things. And this guy, he sees what he wants to see. And
yeah.
Very clear, like when he looks at the picture of what I think is Job.
Yeah, it is Job. It is.
People
Job on the dunghill, I think, is the title of that painting.
Okay, so he's You know, if you don't know the story of Job, this is the point where Job was a wealthy man, God-fearing man. Satan goes to God and says, you know, the only reason this guy loves you is because you've given him all these good things. So God, being the swell God he is, says, you know what? I'm going to temporarily remove my protection from you fucking with this guy. And fuck with him, just don't kill him.
Go for it.
He kills all of his children. He destroys his houses. He kills all of his livestock, destroys his wealth, and afflicts him with a disease, painful disease.
Boils,
And so he sits in on his dung heap and scrapes himself with pottery to relieve his condition. And his wife comes up and says, look, man, curse God and die. Because
which is essentially what his sister tells him in this episode.
Exactly. And I feel like that was the thing where, you know, when he was having sex with his wife in a vision and it flipped to Lori and she goes, why do you persist? I almost think that that was a direct quote from Job's wife. I didn't crack the Bible open to look.
It could be, yeah.
But I feel like that's our opening statement. Why do you persist in this madness? Curse God and die. And of course, he refuses and presses on. But again,
in the end, he is rewarded. Certainly in the end of this episode, unequivocally, you cannot say that he was rewarded unless there's a continuation of the story. And it ultimately turns out that losing this church is the best thing for him.
You're saying he was not rewarded.
He was not. Certainly. No.
So,
I mean, he has 160 grand in cash.
Here's the thing. And I might, this might be a listener take. I'm not sure because sometimes this stuff blends together. If so, when I get to it, I'll give you credit for it. But it's possible that this $140,000, $135,000, whatever he's got left, is what he needs to take care of his wife now.
Okay.
So and what he needs, he doesn't need this, and maybe this is God's way of saying, you do need to give up. Here's what you need to live the rest of your life in comfort and to take care of your wife, because that's what's truly important now. So it could be that he did
thousand is not going to get him through his whole life, but I see your point. But from his perspective,
okay,
he certainly was not rewarded for his faith. And it's random events. We'll talk about this in a second. But yes, there might be more to this story, and ultimately it might turn out good for him. But we don't know that yet. And from his perspective, it was bad. It was very bad. The worst thing that could have happened.
One other thing I want to talk about, because I guess this is just going to be a free-flowing half-assed
cast. There's one storyline I feel like.
The one thing I want to talk about is this guy that comes over for the baptism on the down low. And there's this exquisitely filmed christening. And this, you know, this really shows what a good guy this is. And he really cares for people. He cares for his flock. He cares for his individual child.
Yeah.
And he baptizes this child. And the guy says, wants to donate something. He goes, you know, don't do that. Just talk to your wife who's against religion after the 14th.
Yeah,
and he wants him to recruit his wife in lieu of payment. And I thought, is that a sly hint towards the commonalities that he and his religion and his worldview have with the guilty remnant? Because he's recruiting here, and he's using this guy. He doesn't want his money. He doesn't want that. He wants to recruit him to his cause, and in inadvertently does by this guy giving him this information about the gambling addict. Did you see? Am I crazy for seeing that?
No,
because I feel like eventually that's one of the themes is that the Wayne cult and the guilty remnant cult and maybe the what's left of the shell of these world's great religions are not as different as people might think.
Sure. I think there are parallels to be drawn, and I think the show is drawing them. It might take a while to get to any kind of real resolution with that, or maybe never. Who knows? But yeah, I don't think you're crazy for seeing that in there. I was going to ask you, so we know that the church used to thrive.
Yeah.
Now it's virtually empty.
Sure.
Where to the point where a single baptism is an event, a big turning moment in his church life. Are people actually less religious after the departure? It seems like we've talked about this before, how people would probably view that as a sign. And even his work itself seems like people did take this as a sign. Like it's the rapture. Everyone assumes it's the rapture. And he's trying to tell them it's not. But it doesn't seem like his church is benefiting from this. And I wonder if that's not just – not because – religion as a whole has taken a backseat and people have stopped believing, but because of his actual work that he's doing with the flyers and stuff.
You might have a point, because in the first episode, they show the school And beginning, they do the Pledge of Allegiance. They also do prayer.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is a very unusual thing to see happen in an American public school.
Sure.
In fact, it's against the law, yeah.
In most states, yeah.
But only about half the kids participate. So I could see that one of two ways. Number one, that there's a backlash against religion because not all the kids are participating. Or there is at least among certain segments, there is a rekindling of religious fervor because of it. And maybe, and I think I understand both reactions because in the face of something purely irrational that happens, that's one of the things we had a debate about after the first podcast. It unfortunately didn't get on air. But in the face of an irrational event, I don't think there is a right and wrong rational response.
Yeah.
Other than what you propose as, well, just wait. There is no,
And your response is heavily colored by your beliefs before the event, certainly.
Indeed. Indeed.
So necessarily.
I could buy either way in this world. I kind of felt like they were trying to go to the religion was becoming less effective. But I don't know, because also science has taken a big hit. People have lost faith in that. What do people put faith in this world?
And why would he be on this crusade to say that this is not the rapture if most people didn't believe that this was the rapture and that these were all good people to begin with?
But even a secular observation is like Heroes Day. Can you imagine how galling that is for a man who, regardless of whether you subscribe to your origin story or mine, he's been fucked over by this accident in a way. His wife's not a hero. She's not on that hero's list, but all these bad people are.
That possible judge who disappeared out of the car is, and the one who paralyzed his wife is.
A little losty, though, because the implication of his worldview are, both the innocent and guilty were taken away to either maybe heaven or hell. Mm-hmm. And the rest are left here on Earth as a test. That's purgatory.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the whole planet. The whole Earth is planet lost.
Oh, Jesus. Okay, let's talk a little bit about
his sister.
Oh, we could. I mean, there's so much more to talk about here, but yeah.
Well, I want to talk.
Let's talk about the sister if you want.
First of all, there is a. An email we got from, I can't remember the guy's. I think it's Spencer. I copied and pasted one of his paragraphs and I moved it into the main body, or maybe it's Aaron T. Shit. I still read the rest of his email and thing, but I want to bring it to the main cast. But this, I don't know if you noticed, or actually I do know you noticed because he mentioned it when we watched thing for the second time. But this guy's sister. I forget her name.
Mm-hmm.
Matt's sister.
Nora.
Nora, the one that's slaughtered her whole family.
Lady. Yeah.
Her husband is Lucas from
House of Cards.
House of Cards.
Mm-hmm.
So usually when you cast him like that, and in fact, his wife is the actress that played Donna in The West Wing, which is a big show. I watched the first couple of seasons of it. You usually don't cast these high-profile people unless you're going to do something with them. You certainly wouldn't.
For a photograph on a fridge?
And for her act like a vegetable for roughly 120 seconds of screen time?
Yeah.
That tells
flashbacks,
me there's
going to
be, which is an even more losty, there's going to be some flashbacks. That's a given. I am too.
I love flashbacks.
Lost Problem was not structure.
No, not at all.
So, and to the extent that you even believe that Lost has a problem. So and we love flashbacks most of the time. We love flashbacks on The Walking Dead. We like the kind of flashback story thing of True Detective. I know this is a polarizing opinion. I love Mad Men flashbacks.
Okay.
A lot of people don't. A lot of people don't like to see the old Don crap, but
no,
I love
too,
Mad Men flashbacks. So I'm excited about the possibility of finding out more of this stuff.
Yeah, me too. Absolutely.
How many more bottle episodes like this do you think that this season can sustain?
I am super worried. Like I talked about the momentum coming out of episode two. I'm scared if we get too many of these that we might lose track of the world as a whole. And, the Guilty Remnant. And there's a lot of stuff going on outside of these single characters.
Sure.
That I want to know more about. One of those things that could potentially hurt the show is if we were to have another part of a bottle episode next week. I think that would be a big mistake. But I could see Matt having another episode.
I totally could, too.
Because Christopher Eccleston just absolutely nails the acting in this really, show.
To the extent that I want to go back and give Doctor Who a second chance.
I saw the season with him in it.
The modern incarnation of it. I watched a couple episodes and I couldn't get over the effects and the slot. But
yeah.
He was so compelling in this that I kind of want to go back and give that a second chance just for the hell of it. Just on the strength of his performance, which is kind of remarkable.
It is.
And what's interesting is all the press, like the Sepinwalls and the Greenwalds and the Feinbergs, they got the first three episodes and episode five. Episode four was a skip. People, like Sepinwall, when Ed and saw the fifth episode, Feinberg said, "I'm going to stop at three because I don't want to watch stuff out of order."
Okay.
I wonder why. Mm. Is it because that this is going to be a little two-episode arc with him? That's going to be a way to kick off and, you know, explain more about the guilty remnant and the stakes and everything, and then having that emotional payload delivered, they're going to then continue purely with going through the plot.
It could be because, okay, when do we want to talk about the dream that he had? Because
later. We've got...
later, yeah. Much later.
Yeah, that's the climax of the podcast, man.
Sure. All right.
One other question I have to ask about this scene with his sister.
Yeah.
Why? Did he drop the note about her husband cheating on his preschool? I know he's desperate.
That's really the reason
But why would you do that to your little sister?
You're asking a rhetorical question. You know the real answer, but you're just like, oh my God, I can't believe he did that.
Well, it's a combination of if I thought that he thought it even had a 50% chance of working.
Uh-huh.
But as a man who has a kid sister... My kid's sister loses her entire family, and I know this devastating detail. I'm not going to drop it extortion style, almost,
on her. I feel like this was an extension of what he did with the guy at the casino, where he was saying, look, you have a reason for me to continue the work that I'm doing.
But I think it's the opposite, because she's not a better person for knowing the truth. Absolutely.
I agree with that, but he needs money to continue what he's doing. And he, in my mind, he thinks that telling her this is going to show her how important it is somehow. I mean, it seems...
I'm willing to hurt you this bad.
Well, he also says it's the one story I'll never tell. So he's telling her, I'm going to continue doing this if you can give me the money to allow me to do it, but I promise I will never write this story.
It seemed from a man who seems so empathetic, and maybe that's the point.
Yeah. No, you're right.
That's the point. That's the extent he's willing to go. Yeah. That he's willing to hurt himself and the people he loves because he's so committed to this cause.
Sure.
So, I don't have a problem with it. It's just one of those things where it was another part of the tragedy of the episode. I just gobsmacked at the audacity.
Yeah. It's such a bad situation and such a bad decision to make there. But he makes it anyway. And I don't – you're right. I don't think it detracts from the episode. So when I first saw him getting this money, I was kind of wondering what he was going to do with it. I hadn't put all the pieces together with the pigeons and everything yet. And he takes it to the casino and I'm like, okay, now I see the pigeons thing.
It's a Fred Smith gambit.
He's going to go in there and just play penny slots for the next 15 years, hoping to get his money.
And subsist on alcohol and cigarette smoke.
Yeah. Yeah.
Did you know that Fred Smith actually did this?
I didn't. Who is Fred Smith?
Fred Smith is the CEO and creator of FedEx. And in the early days, before people saw the wisdom, and FedEx is now ubiquitous, they had a moment where they had a $25,000 fuel bill due.
And ooh, they had Jesus.
He had $5,000, which was their payroll money. In the bank. So either can make payroll.
So he needs three bets.
So he went to Las Vegas and he gambled their payroll money and turned it into $27,000 through an all night game of blackjack.
You hear that, guys? Every dollar you put into Subbable goes to the casino.
If we ever get
you're not opposed to this idea. I can tell.
If we got to the bottom of our funding barrel, uh-huh. But it's like, and we could see that if we just had six more months of funding that we would turn the corner.
Uh-huh.
You could talk me into taking my last $5,000 and going to Horseshoe Casino.
Put it on red.
And yeah, I mean, why the hell not? Because what is in the grand scheme of things, what the fuck is $5,000 going to do for me?
Yeah, it's and not going to see you through the rest of your life, certainly.
If we could somehow transmute that into 6 months worth of funding, it could permanently change our lives. So
yeah.
I I think it's slightly unethical because I did some research. I was always told us in FedEx lore that this is something Fred Smith did with the approval of his corporate officers and employees. Mm-hmm. The articles I read and before I talked about this in the podcast indicated, no, he just did it because he's like, well, we're going to go bankrupt one way or another. What the fuck?
Wow.
That seems like, bully for him. It worked. American success story. But my God, if not, sure. You're now in super hot water because you can't make payroll and that's illegal. So
yeah.
Anyway.
Whew, okay. Well, I'm glad FedEx is around as an alternative to UPS. Can you imagine if we just had UPS?
Or the post office?
Yeah, nobody really uses the post office for shipping freight, right?
Except for Bald Move.
Well, we have to do it on the cheap. So there's an idea that's brought up in the beginning of this episode about whether you see things that happen to you as punishment or reward for your actions and how it's very, like we were talking earlier, very much open to interpretation. I'm struggling to see exactly where the point is where that comes into this episode. I know it's kind of woven throughout the whole episode. There's a lot of decisions he makes and a lot of things that happen to him from the time he's seven. Or his sister is seven. He's who knows how old. Eight, I think, is what he says.
He was 10 when she was parents, born.
He was 10 when she was born?
10 years old when she was born, yeah. You can see him being an older boy walking into church when his mother is standing there holding. I mean, I interpreted that in that part of that flashback as his father is preaching at the old congregation, and he's walking past into the little vestibule that then turns into a cancer treatment section.
And that's him.
And
the boy is him.
Yeah, the boy is him, but you see him from the back, and he looks like he's 8 to 10 years old, and his mom's got a baby in the front row cradling it. So,
okay.
Yeah, so which means that when
he'd been like 17 when
he'd been 17 when
his parents died.
Right.
So, but you can interpret, you know, his parents dying, all the really bad things that happened to him in this episode as test, you know, through the Job metaphor.
There's also something about the fire and how the church changed hands that is not kosher too. Did you get that when he was having that fight with his sister? He's like, you know,
the church wasn't given to us.
We had a fire and then he cut her off. Now it could be that she's just saying that, you know, well, God killed her parents, we could have a church. That's stupid. Or it could be that there's something more to that story that he didn't want to think about right then.
Or she could be saying that when her parents died she stopped believing in God.
Mm-hmm.
And that the church wasn't left to us, it was left to you because I didn't give a shit about it.
Okay.
I feel like that's more where she was going with that, but I'm not certain.
Right.
But I feel like, you know, Matt is viewing this as he's rewarded up until the point where he loses the church. Then he certainly has to view that as a punishment.
But he's already been through this multiple times as a child, and this is something every older...
Well, so I think this might be him changing his mind on things a little bit at the very end. Because he has been through these tests and he's always viewed them as tests and not necessarily punishments, but rewards for tests for a future reward. And now everything he's worked for is lost. Everything around him, he views himself as Job. Everything around him is gone.
You're right, because
Job doesn't ever relent, though. And Job's faith sees him through.
He's eventually rewarded.
And he is.
Like threefold or fivefold or sevenfold.
So when do you look at those things and say that it is a punishment for something I did wrong versus this is just another test to get me to my reward?
I think it's the latter. And as you always like to say, the language of cinema, when he looks at the guilty remnant and they play the angry, ominous horns.
Yeah, yeah.
That is an apocalyptic battle music. That is not...
I now see
the error of my ways.
Sure, I'm coming at this as a more general question. If you have this idea that tests are just kind of a ramp up to an eventual reward for passing them all, is there ever something bad that happens that you say is a punishment? I would say no.
He's been trained. He was a child. He had this blessing that was a test, and he prayed for attention, and he got cancer. Obviously, he beat that.
Sure.
Then his parents were killed, but he got to church and his reward, and he met his wife. That's a reward. So he's been trained that you meet adversity and you keep your faith and eventually you move on to bigger and better things and your life gets richer.
But when you continually get punished for no apparent reason.
How long does it take you to give up?
Yes.
That's an excellent question.
And I think it's one that they're addressing in this episode, and that is not resolved in this episode.
No, I think it surely is going to be resolved. And the other thing is, you know, I go back and forth about this disappearing thing. If it seems like it's an act of God. You know, you and I have had this big debate about
you can't
make that conclusion. Well, I, as a rational person, have made the conclusion that there is something supernatural afoot here.
Okay. I would not leap to that conclusion, but all right.
So in this world, you know, where God has got plans and does things to people, I don't know what you do when you see signs and you're supposed to, you think you have a mission. How can anyone tell you otherwise?
Yeah,
you know, how can anyone tell you you're crazy in a world where something crazy has happened?
Okay. That's a fair point.
So it's like he's got almost a super, and we know how strong people that fervently believe in religious beliefs, how strong their mental armor is to resist change. He's got like supercharged Zoltan level shielding about this stuff. I don't know. I don't know if I answered your question.
No, and I don't think it was meant. It's a question that you're supposed to think about. You're supposed to look internally, I think, at your own views and question kind of your preconceptions about things,
right?
About why things happen to you, why things happen for you.
He does seem to be continually punished for doing good things. You try to help you know.
Yeah, let's talk about this rock.
You are opening arms and being welcoming towards the guilty remnant.
Yeah.
They buy your church. You try to help these people out when they get hit in the face with a potato. You get a rock in the face.
You say it's a potato.
You try to save.
You say potato. I say rock.
It looks like a fucking Idaho spud.
Yeah,
is what I'm saying.
I don't know how a potato does that much damage to a man. How does it crack open your skull?
Let me ask
you
this:
bleed?
What if the guilty remnant engineered that as a part of the conversion process? No, that's
Whoa,
that can't.
You're going
that's,
very lost now.
Unless
where's Benjamin Linus? Where is he?
Unless their head of their cult, which I can't remember her name, unless she's like the Joker.
Yeah.
Level of planning, there's no way they can make that happen.
Yeah, I don't think you saw into season 4, but Benjamin Linus is kind of the mastermind, like the ultimate mastermind in Lost. Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to think. We're to the point where we didn't talk about Lori hanging around Kevin's place.
Yeah,
when he went
to
dig up the thing. So you interpreted that as she's not as on board with the guilty remnant as we suspect. I interpreted that as she's on board. She just is paying significant personal costs to be on board.
Yeah, you might be right. I took what we saw last episode, you know, when she was trying to get Meg to give up her stuff, and Meg's like, don't you have anything that, like, were you okay with giving up everything you have?
Yeah.
And she's like, kinda. I'm Kevin's wife.
But this wasn't like a cult tactic of recruiting purely. This is something that's a real thing that she struggles with. That she cares about her family, misses them, curious about what, you know, wants to see them safe and happy, I guess. But not bad enough to, you know, leave the cult and rejoin humanity.
Sure. She obviously went. It feels like she went to them by choice and mostly unprovoked by the departure. It wasn't like she lost a bunch of people in her family
Unless
and decided this is my only option.
The take we had last week where she suffered a departed miscarriage.
Sure.
I thought is mind blowing. You know, that's.
Yeah, that idea is just.
I mean, it's. There's so many
cool
things.
And disturbing.
Yeah. And yeah. And probably offensive to a lot of people.
Probably, yeah.
On two different sides of the political spectrum.
Yeah.
So yeah, I was amazing. One of the things I love about the show is that it asks these questions and doesn't necessarily even give you answers. It just is like, hey, contemplate this.
And I'm
contemplate
okay with
this
that.
Miserable existence.
Yeah, some things I want answers to. Other things I think they're just as effective or potentially more effective without answers, because they get you to think and they get you to challenge what you think and why you think it.
All right.
Where do we stand on the dream? Do you want to talk about the dream yet? Are we there?
Stand on the dream. Yeah, I think we're ready because he gets hit in the face with the rock. He's got the money. We've talked about.
Well, let's stop there for a second because I know that you historically have problems with coincidence in shows driving the plot.
Yep.
This is a case where a coincidence, him just happening to drive down the same road where a guy happens to get hit in the head with a rock, drives the plot. How did you feel about this and why?
He had agency. The him as a character, I mean, these are all things
he could have just kept driving.
Yes. Like, if it had ricocheted off their head and then gone through his windshield and hit him. But still, it's there's, you know, these are all things that can happen.
There are levels of believable.
And him rolling three reds in a row.
Yeah.
That happens.
Yeah, sure. All the time.
And he took all these coincidences. A lot of these coincidences were man-made. It's our human brain has evolved to detect patterns because it serves us well. You know, these types of foods make us sick. These types of seasons are good to migrate. These types of times are when we plant. The better we do at making these patterns, more successful we are. And now we get into our modern world and it works against us because we see patterns where there are none.
Hmm.
A lot of these coincidences were his own in the making. The only one that's really a coincidental thing is the Guilty Remnant hanging out there and being assaulted and him being part of it. But again, he had agency. He saw that his compassion and outrage made him stop, pull over, and try to give assistance. And then he became part of the hate crime himself.
Yeah. Okay. I can buy it. It wasn't a super stretch for me. And yeah. I notoriously don't have a problem with coincidences as they affect the plot. But just wanted to get your opinion on that. Before we get to the dream, I want to talk about a couple of things because I accidentally caught episode one again over the past week. And there were several things I noticed.
Oh, God damn it. Got caught this episode one up in my face. Jesus.
And I was strapped down and forced to watch it. So there are a few things that we talked about in last episode and even the first episode where some information from episode one escaped me because I wasn't paying close enough attention that might contribute to the discussion. Specifically as it relates to Kevin being crazy and the dog shooter. I feel like the Bagels put an end cap on that, significant end cap. But there is a moment where Kevin, when he first sees that dog, he's jogging, he first sees that dog, he reaches for his gun, which is not on him, of course, because he's jogging. Why would you jog with a gun? But he instinctively reaches for his gun. Mm-hmm. Now, I could see that as being evidence for he shot the dog, certainly. That's just another piece of a potential puzzle.
Yeah, no, that's
no comments about that. Okay,
that's a good point.
All right, and then another thing I noticed is I feel like the Guilty Remnant is a much, much smaller group because we've talked about this as well last episode. And I thought I was under the impression that the Guilty Remnant was a huge worldwide or potentially at least national thing.
I believe that is at least my impression is a regional, at least regional, like it's in the Northeast.
Okay. Well, so there's a line in the first episode where Kevin's talking about the Guilty Remnant, and he says, a year ago, these people didn't exist. Now they have a cul-de-sac. And somebody, I feel like somebody somewhere has mentioned something about 50 Guilty Remnant being in the area.
But that's this. So you're asking, a year ago, these people didn't exist, and he's talking about the cult, and then he switches into... now they own a cul-de-sac in our community. I don't think that's enough evidence to say that it's either
these people
regional
didn't
or
exist.
Not.
These people didn't exist tells me
these people,
the guilty remnant did not exist
as a movement.
Yes.
And then a year ago they were founded.
So in a year, this cul-de-sac sprung up in the community, but also other cul-de-sacs potentially nationwide.
I think you can interpret it either way. I don't think there's enough information to tell.
I can buy that. Yeah.
There is an official, I mean, we're getting like book spoilers and stuff. Cause there's an official Guilty Remnant website that's ran by the author that I accidentally stumbled upon.
Is it? I'm not certain that it's run by the author, but it feels like it is.
It
links back to his Facebook page.
Yeah.
And he has like an email list and stuff like that.
Yeah. I feel like, I mean, I don't know. I haven't done the Who Is on it. I probably should have. I didn't know you were going to bring this up, but, I feel like it probably is an official thing, and I feel like I'm not going to spoil, but I do feel like that there's a certain conclusion you are to draw from that website about its reach and maybe even some of its philosophies and teachings that you probably shouldn't go and investigate if you don't want any spoilers at all.
Yeah,
so But from the show, I don't know. I don't know what to believe.
And we don't know how long the show, the season is going to take to play out. Maybe it's a multi-year arc in this season.
Right.
And the Guilty Remnant, by the end of it, are nationwide. Who knows?
Well, we don't know. Are they going to do the whole first? Are they going to do the whole book as the first season? Or are they going to do like half of it? And then,
yeah,
I don't know. We don't know any of those. And also, sure. I take it that there's significant deviations from the book already. So yeah. We don't know anything about anything.
Sure. Absolutely. But, you know, people are discussing this. I figure we should discuss it. And it's certainly interesting to think about and may have bigger implications. Anyway, how about this dream, yo?
It's great because there's this really interesting thing where he plays this kid as in many different phases of his life, but it's always his grown self. And he's moving backwards in time and forwards in time, and there's people from his present in the past, and things morph from his wife having sex with her to Lori, and then he wakes up and he's on fire and he's screaming, and we go back to the day of the departure. There was one interesting detail about the BMW, and then on the passenger side of the BMW, there was a giant round hole as if someone had thrown something through it. Now, you said, well, maybe it got blown out in an accident. Mm-hmm. My understanding of the way safety glass work, that if it was just blown out because it got, you know, the frame warped, it would just shatter.
Completely fall apart.
This thing looked like someone punched through it or threw a rock
through
it.
Or someone threw a potato through it.
Someone sputted it up. Someone sputted the BMW. I wonder if we're going to have a flashback where that is significant, that there's more to the judge taking bribes or...
I feel like all of our questions are not answered in this episode.
And there might not be. This might be me taking something from nothing. So
could be, but we know there are other questions that are posed and not answered in this episode. That might be one of them.
And this Joe picture continually was a theme throughout this dream. I think it flashed in three different places of his life. Yeah. But, you know, again, the Joe theme, I don't think there's anything more there than... Literally, he identifies with Job because he fucking is Job.
There doesn't need to be anything more. Yeah. It's pretty significant as
it's very surface reading, I think.
Yeah.
Unless there's a tornado that comes at the end and God speaks out of it, I think the Job parallel is done, you know?
So it shows him, it really gave me a sense of how much trauma he has had in his life and how many tests, as he would view them, have been handed to him. I mean, his...
That's why
his parents die in the fire. And
he had cancer that was aggressive and keep coming back, but he beat it.
He's got the cancer. You can see how well the church was doing at the time when his father was the minister. And now look at it. I mean, you look at it in the beginning of the episode. Nobody's there. So even his father's legacy, his family church, has crumbled into nothing.
Sure.
And now it's taken directly out from under him with the Guilty Remnant buying it. I mean, this is a man that I feel... really bad.
This is the equivalent of the scene in Kung Pao Enter the Fist where the guy just gets hit by sticks.
Okay. Yeah.
And he just gets, he's like, for a good five solid minutes, the guys get worn out and like out of breath. And then they kind of look shrugged and resuming beating him. This was just Doctor Who getting this shit beat out of him physically, literally, mentally, emotionally, spiritually, the whole gamut. And it was – I also found this vision very moving because, you know, it had the whole – the sister, are they burning in there? That's a devastating question for – I mean, that's how old my son is, and I can't even imagine.
Sure, and you have to view him as a 17-year-old with his 7-year-old sister standing beside him. He barely understands it, let alone what can he say to her to make her understand it.
Or feel better or comfort her. Yeah. You need comfort yourself.
He sees the firefighters in the background with a picture of Job between them on the fire truck. To me, saying this is a test.
Yeah.
That's him. Him seeing that picture there says that he's thinking of this.
All
as a
these
test.
Things he saw as, as tests.
So some good visual storytelling.
And Christopher Eccleston, his performance of all this, and then at the end when he goes and he realizes he's 3 days late to the bank, and he plays that just a man trying to piece together the world that doesn't make sense anymore.
Yeah.
That's a hard thing to portray. If someone said, you know. portray existential confusion right now. That's not easy. And he really sold it. And the guy that was playing the bank manager,
Christopher Eccleston, shows up on set. What are we doing today, boys? existential crisis. All right. Bam. Got it.
They actually beat him with sticks for 5 minutes to get him into the mood to play that. But even the small performances, and his sister crushed it. The bank manager. Yeah. I felt so incredibly bad for that guy.
Sure.
As the soulless bureaucrat that suffers the misfortune of having a soul and a heart.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and yeah, the fact that he did it to himself by burying his head in the ground for 2 weeks. Like, what if he'd done this 2 weeks ago?
But his kind-hearted nature also did it to him, because he had the money, he was headed for the bank, and then he got out to help those people.
But if he hadn't ducked this guy's calls for 2 weeks, tragedies wrapped up in a nice little enchilada.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a moment in the dream that I really am curious about, and it is the moment where a couple of moments. One where he's fucking Kevin Garvey's wife.
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting. And what questions does that raise? Is that all right? Okay, I want
to
wrap this up.
I'm prepared to say you're reaching a little bit.
No. I'm going to ask questions. I'm not drawing conclusions, because I don't know that we can.
Okay.
This is just a vision that he's having. So his hands catch on fire.
Okay.
In this vision, and then the fire springs up around him. Right after he has had sex with Kevin's wife in the vision.
Uh huh.
And as a matter of fact, she's still on the bed with him. I'm wondering, given that vision, given what happens at the end, that the church is taken out from under him by the guilty remnant, given how he reacts when he beats that man and takes the money from him, back from him, if Matt isn't going to burn down this church. Because the fire, I mean, we see the toner on his hands early in the episode.
Which is a great way to say.
Which is like an allusion to blood on your hands. Same with the fire. Yeah, okay. It's kind of where I'm going.
I think it's foreshadowing that he is going to meet a gruesome death at the hand of a squadron of skeletal warriors.
What? What pop culture reference are you making right now?
It's hilarious that you don't get it, but I can't even shed light without it being a spoiler.
Oh,
boom!
Okay,
you got it. You got it.
Got it.
If you don't get it, maybe one day you will. If you get it, then enjoy.
All right. What do you think about that? Because his hands catch on fire. He's having sex with Lori. His bed then catches on fire. It feels to me like he's going to burn down this church. The hands
Lori,
on fire.
Lori pussy good is what that tells me.
And he feels like he's going to hell for what he's going to do with the fire springing up around him. That's the impression I got.
But it's also his parents died in a fire. I can see him. One of our Facebook contributors, Juwan, I believe, said that he totally sees him like chaining up this church and firebombing it with all these guilty remnant inside.
Potentially, yeah.
And the way we leave them at the end of this episode, it's, I could believe any dark path you could mint, because this seems, you know, he seems like a man that has met Satan to his face for the first time and now knows what he must do. At least that's what I saw.
Sure. Yeah, I could definitely see
or
that
you could
in
pull
his face.
Liv Tyler, and now he joins them as their ally. I mean, nothing would surprise me.
The other big question I have that does not have an answer is, about him and Lori having sex, is this something that has already happened? Is this something that is going to happen?
No.
Potentially. Okay, let me lay out a scenario. Lori and... So his wife gets paralyzed. He obviously can't have sex with her. He has the vision of having sex with her, remembering what that was like. And then it switches to Lori. Could this be something that he's already done? Could it be that he had sex with Lori...
Could it? Sure. I don't.
All right, well, let me finish laying out the scenario. He had sex with Lori. Lori and he both feel very guilty about that. Lori feels so guilty that she leaves her family and goes to the guilty remnant. For some reason, of course. I mean, it would have to be some reason that I can't explain. I just feel like there's a lot of significance there, and it isn't all wrapped up in the church.
I mean, he's also having a dream, and he's incorporating things from all of his life, his current, his past. I mean, the guilty remnant girl gave him a hymn when he walked in the door. Did he fuck her, too? I mean, some of these things are just a remix of all of his memories, having his near-death experience.
Yeah, memories. That's and his current experience.
What I'm what rolling, and honestly, I feel like about. it would harm his character for him to behave in an immoral way. That's not Job. That's not Job's arc.
I don't know.
Job
I mean,
did nothing to sure. deserve what he got.
I agree with that.
So that's the other reason I don't like it.
Okay. I don't know that his arc necessarily needs to be exactly that of Job's. I think it could just
sure.
serve the purpose of this one episode.
Right. No, yeah. I'm not saying you're wrong.
I don't know. I mean, his quest to say that not all these people were good might have something to do with his own internal feeling of guilt is kind of where I'm coming from. I don't know. There are so many questions that dream inspires and not many answers to be found.
My take on the dream is it did not bring up any questions. It's just straightforward.
So you know why he was fucking Lori in that dream.
Yeah.
You know why his hands burst into flame.
I think it's it's a remix of all of his memories and a near-death experience, and it's giving context to things like we wouldn't otherwise have a plausible way to flashback to the crash and flashback to him being diagnosed with cancer and all these things were hinted at. This is because I talked about the three-step reveal where you do something for the clever viewers and then you do something for kind of the, sort of average and then you do something to like make sure everybody gets. I feel like this dream sequence was the one where you did a lot of hinting and illusion and now you're just going to out and out show this guy's Job. Getting like the pudgy Princess Leia handing out tracks at the door, that doesn't mean anything other than he was on her mind recently.
It's maybe I've been trained by Lost.
That's
and the
fine.
Fact that Damon Lindelof
I'm not
is,
attacking you,
no,
man.
I know you're not.
Okay.
I'm just saying this. Maybe
I think we
maybe
should move
this
on.
Is a justification for why I'm thinking this. But I also want to bring up one other thing.
Okay.
As regards to numbers. We know numbers were huge.
Yes.
Mystery in
yes,
Lost. The
are you going with the Epiphany board?
No, I'm actually not. I'm going with the number. You can get to that later because I know you did a little research on that.
Yeah, it's nothing.
It's nothing?
It's just the hymns that they're going to sing that during that prayer, during the service.
Are there any particular hymns that might relate to his situation?
I will. If the listeners want to look up every one of those hymn numbers and see, they're free to do so.
You're
but
a fucking professional podcaster, man.
Once I found out that those epiphanies were hymns and it's just part of the thing, it's like, you know, looking up movie show times. I'm like, okay.
But that's the thing.
Not going
to
do it.
I like to. Part of Lost was watching all the tiny little hints that they may or may not have put in there purposely.
Mm-hmm.
And oftentimes, you know, retroactively
just
wrote.
With you.
Yeah, they retconned it. But they're the numbers that come up on the roulette wheel are 3, 23, and 25. And someone went on Google, did a search for the numbers 3, 23, and 25. And the first thing that comes up is Colossians 3, verses 23 through 25. And they say, whatever you do, work at it with all your heart as working for the Lord, not for human masters, since you know that you will receive an inheritance from the Lord as a reward. Is the Lord Christ you are serving. Anyone who does wrong will be repaid for their wrongs, and there is no favoritism.
Slow clap. That I like.
You do like that.
I don't think it means anything, but I think it's a
sure.
It's probable that they didn't just pull that shit out of their
certainly,
ass.
Yeah. I think those numbers came up for a reason. There's also, I mean, if you look at Job 3:23-25. There's maybe a little relevance there, but not. It doesn't seem to be as much. The
well,
part
until
that stuck
Tom,
with me,
until Tom Cruise shows up and searches for it on Usenet.
Okay,
I'm not sure it's a thing.
All right.
Need to see Tom Cruise searching in a hotel room on Usenet for Job.
Fair. That's completely fair. the one part of this that really stuck with me though is that last verse. Anyone who does wrong will be repaid for the wrongs, and there is no favoritism. He did a lot of wrong this episode.
Yes, he did.
That has me worried about, maybe not worried about his future, but maybe the repayment was losing that church. Maybe the rock to the face was the repayment for beating a man to take money that he got gambling. And used a federal, and used a judge's bribe money to do that.
I think that is one of the points I was going to make towards at the wrap up of this as well, that he's on this quest to do this righteous thing, but he's done a lot of unrighteous things to get there.
Yeah.
And that this could be, you know, they're there. And it's again, going back to the title of the episode, God is trying to tell him to do one thing. And instead of putting his faith in, because, like, you know, this guy jumped him and beat him up. Sure. Maybe that was part of God's plan, too. Yeah. Maybe that was a sign. Mm-hmm. You went against that.
Yeah.
You know, maybe that guy would have gotten caught and thrown in jail, and you would have gotten the money back anyway. It's like, who knows? But you subverted God's will, and you took it into your own hands. Something that, by the way, Job never did.
That's true. He just depended on God.
And he kept on, you know, he got a little big for his britches at the end, but he never actually went against and sinned against God, and took matters into his own hand. So there is definitely some of that. And how this show is going to deal with cosmic justice or the existence of God and all that, I don't know. But that's definitely an interesting question.
Okay. One other thing on the signs. Did you notice that it was one, two, and then three pigeons?
Yes, I did know that.
Okay. That's it.
Okay.
What else do you want to talk about?
The guilty remnant as human cancer.
Okay. All right.
You know, cancer is a normal cell that mutates and becomes malignant, and it starts reproducing uncontrollably and begins to subvert normal systems and turn them into not functioning things and eventually kills you that way. Mm-hmm. The guilty remnant are these former human beings, were productive, they loved.
Former human beings.
Formerly productive human beings that had loves and hopes and ambitions, and they contributed to the GDP, and they destroyed things and created things. Now, they are just these things that are converting their worldly goods into things that make more of themselves. Mm. And whitewashing houses, that's cancer. They smoke. Are they literally an Agent Smith style commentary on humanity, that they're just becoming a cancer, that they're an extinction plan for humanity?
I don't think you're completely wrong with that. I know you're just asking questions here.
Yeah, I don't even really want an answer. I just think that that's a cool parallel.
It certainly is. Yeah, and it's something to think about. I think there's a lot of GR hate rolling around, and I would say we don't know enough about them yet to say that they're a bad guy, that they're something to be worked against.
They're awfully sympathetic for a bad guy. On the other hand, you know, cancer's not evil.
Sure.
It's not good.
Objectively, it is not evil.
It is a force.
To humans, it is.
It's just a force of nature.
Yeah.
And, you know, I kind of dig that cosmic take on this cult.
Sure.
They're not evil. They're not good. They just
exist.
They're just humanity, humanity with a screw loose, and the natural outpouring of what happens next from that. From when people just have no rational or religious hope, this is what happens.
Yeah, and I mean, we've talked about them having a very nihilistic worldview.
Right.
At some point. So you could say that they're not even working toward a real goal necessarily. They just think that there is no point, and that they want other people to know that there is no point.
Sure.
Right?
Well, we've got a ton of feedback.
Let's get to it.
I'm going to do a very light pimping. If you'd like to support us, go to subbable.com/baldmove to find out how you can directly contribute and get some cool stuff in return. If you shop on Amazon, use amazon.baldmove.com. It costs you nothing and gives us money. Rate and review us on iTunes, because that's how we grow like cancer. And tell friends or family for the same. Mm-hmm. And let's get on the feedback. Spencer H. says, my biggest and most nagging thought is, who the hell is Lori emailing? This is previous episode feedback.
Okay. Yeah.
Got a lot of it, but I'm only reading stuff that is probably an open answer now. My biggest, most nagging thought is, who the hell is Lori emailing, and what the fuck did the email say? She was composing something on a laptop before cult leader came in and slammed the door shut.
Sure. She's emailing her ongoing lover, Matt Christopher Eccleston.
I couldn't get a freeze frame without a blurry image. Same. And I've seen nothing about it on Reddit, which is probably why. Is she undercover and investigating the GR somehow? Is she emailing her husband because she misses him?
Oh, undercover.
that would be an interesting thing if she was trying to bring it down from the inside, and that's why she's pushing to be, even though she's got misgivings, she's pushing to be at the forefront. And
yeah,
I don't know. I like that take a lot.
Me too.
He asks, are we sure the guilty women exist outside this town? We actually had a fairly good discussion about that. He mentions that Jill clearly sees the dog shooter, but Amy did not so much as glance at him. There's more than one parallel drawn between Wayne's group and the guilty remnant. Meg says, I don't want to feel this way anymore. And Wayne says, you don't have to feel this way anymore.
Yeah.
Meg eats pancakes with a whipped cream smiley face. Wayne gives Tom a cell phone with a smiley face. We talked about that. This is supporting evidence that these are kind of two sides of the same coin, the same cult coin.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. I mean, they're two reactions to... it's a natural reaction that everyone is going to have, probably, to feel bad about these 2% of the people disappearing.
Sure.
But how you react is certainly a big question in this series. And kind of ignoring it and deciding that I'm going to feel okay is one response, and another is to let it fester and with inside you. And kind of eat away at you, like the guilty remnant. I feel like they're doing that, whereas Wayne's cult is happy-go-lucky.
But also getting chased around by armed federal agents. They're seen as seen as more overtly threatening at this stage.
Sure.
Double A Ron T says, just want to give two quick comments regarding Kevin's sanity and his dog killer stranger. First, only Kevin's daughter interacts with the stranger, not her friend, which is something that... Spencer H. also observed, since she is of Kevin's blood, maybe she has some of his crazy inner, which allows her to see him. Second, Kevin finds the burnt bangles, then he walks like an Egyptian. But did he really? Only he sees the bagels and no one else is around. He should be imagining it all. That's not a non-solid point.
So, yeah, none of this is non-solid, right?
Right.
Like, there are...
I feel like Dan Deardorff here. I'm not so sure that this isn't a good parallel of something not being crazy. What? What side are you
I'm
on?
I'm not so sure that what you said is not really crazy.
What are you going to say?
No, he's right. There is evidence to support both sides of this are the bagels real argument.
We need to have a soundboard where we can play the loss every single time there's an open question.
We do.
Edgar E. said, the guy who is head of security at Wayne's Ranch, and you also see him shot dead in a gas station and open mouth kissed by Wayne, is Peter Berg, the director of the first two episodes.
Nice.
Dropping some trivia on us.
Cool.
RJ Duncan said, all right, theory time. Now we move on to the new stuff, by the way.
Okay, good.
Maybe the 2% of the removed people were a direct result of their remained family. Members doing wrong at that point in their history. In other words, the only thing that was planned was a set point in time, and the removal of the removed were the lesser of the evil ones at that point. Perhaps this explains Kevin's family, all their douchebags in some, in some sort of fashion, and a newborn baby's removed from their particular equation. Also, as a side note, maybe it was Durst that Kevin was in bed with when we see him being asked what he was doing upon the removal, and that is why her whole family got removed. She's the one in the wrong, and at that point in her equation. I don't know about that, but I do like the fact that Durst and Kevin, that they rope-a-dope and they filmed that as if she was departed and as he was having sex with her. Uh-huh. I still think that's actually what happened. Okay. But what if they actually were having sex, and that's also explained some of her extreme reaction this episode? That, my husband is cheating, and I cheated, her extreme reaction can be explained just by her brother being a prick.
Sure.
But I thought that, what do you think about
that's an interesting theory.
The removed people?
Those being the less evil of all the people? I mean, there were child abusers removed, departed.
What's to say, it's like, how fucked up is the remaining people?
Well, come on, if a child abuser is removed and their child is not, that's not the lesser of two evils.
Yeah, that's a good poking hole in that theory. So all right, I'm with you. I'm anti RJ on that one, but I do like
sorry RJ.
I do like the Durst and Kevin angle.
Yeah.
Jim J said, I find it pretty interesting that Matt's wife accident was caused by October 14th. She wasn't one of the departed, but her condition was actually caused by one of the people disappearing. Millions of people around the world must have went through something similar, and it must be pretty infuriating to hear the names of people who disappeared hailed as heroes, while the people who died as a result of disappearance were an afterthought. Seems like that's probably a lot of the motivation behind what Matt is doing. Excellent take. Excellent point.
Yeah.
Anything to add to that?
No, I like it.
Alexander K., I really don't get all the talk about this being a dark or heavy show. The girl watching her family burn to death, the music, the quick cuts. It's also over the top that I was laughing more than anything. In the end,
what?
Dude still has 140 large. If they had focused on him losing his wife to a ghost car, that could have been powerful. But instead, we see nothing of the pre-rapture relationship because the focus is on manufacturing tension out of this unbelievable casino hijinks. Alexander, I profoundly disagree with you.
Yep.
But I read your email as a example of the polarization that, you know, he sees this misery porn, which is someone's another person on Facebook called it, as absurd, over the top, a farce, keeping him from connecting with it. Where for me, it really pulled me in. And I don't think either one of us are wrong.
Sure. Subjective, certainly.
Jamie T says, this episode made the first two look like network schlock. It was masterful. For once, the questions raised were answered in a perfect tempo. Good point. Very few questions were raised in this episode that aren't immediately answered or kind of promised very quickly to come.
Sure. Yeah.
I love the religious undertones, like the minister being dead for 3 days and being unprepared for the moment of reckoning.
Huh.
Very Christ-like.
Yeah, yeah.
The bank manager telling the minister that it doesn't matter. You're too late, despite his excuses, reminded me of the scenario painted for me in my Christianity-laced childhood, how the unsaved would sound to God after their death. All the excuses and good intentions and begging the world won't save you if you're a second too late. Much like a piece of music, this episode hit all the main melody notes with the guilty remnant overtaking Christianity as the religion de jour, while also bringing into harmony our minister reaping exactly the pain he sowed. And somehow I'm still rooting for him. Bravo.
Yeah, I'm with her. Another solid point. I'm definitely with her on the idea that by comparison, the first two episodes are kind of shit. The first two episodes had me interested in the kind of way where I'm hoping they'll explain more and I'm hoping that they will form a cohesive world. Whereas this episode was just a character study, a character arc that I really, really enjoyed. And she's right, was executed masterfully.
Nikki P was the one that suggested that he could take this money as a blessing to take care of himself and his wife. So I wanted to give her credit for that.
Okay.
JD says, hey, I wanted to start by saying I was on a fence about this show until this episode. I absolutely loved how they told the story of the priest and getting to learn some of his background. The gambling scene was extremely intense, and I loved how he went back after the guy that took his money. I was seriously going to be furious if they had him lose his money that quickly. I really liked how this episode, and it seemed, at least to me, to give more answers instead of questions. This makes me optimistic about the show. Some quick thoughts. To me, the priest believes the 14th was a day when some people went to heaven and some went to hell, and everybody in between was left behind as a test. At least this is what it seems to me. The priest is trying to show people that there is a reason to continue having faith and believing in something, that they still go to church, etc., because there is still hope for the people left behind. The jury is out on them, basically. Okay. So that's the purgatory take.
Yep.
I think we covered that fairly well. Spencer H. double-dipped on us, said, we see the preachers having some strange encounters with pigeons, much like Kevin with the deer. What do these have in common? I believe they both saw someone disappear before their eyes. They imply the woman Kevin was sleeping with disappeared out from underneath him, and the preacher could have seen the driver disappear as he or she is driving towards his car, which would explain why the first thing he does is not to check on his wife, but to go look inside the other car. In the pilot episode, the kids who helped Kevin's daughter bury the dog say that only the dogs that went crazy were the ones that actually saw someone disappear. I believe there's some parallel there, although I'm not sure what it means. If you actually saw someone disappear, that you lose your grip on sanity, I could get behind that. I think I would.
I don't know. He doesn't seem insane to me.
Who?
Matt.
Really?
No. He just seems to...
He saw a picture move and speak to him.
Yeah, I guess I took that more of a device for storytelling.
Sure.
Not as him physically seeing it move. I don't know. So you
what
think
those
that
birds?
He actually
the,
saw them move?
Well, he's saying, like, just in the same way that kind of things are played fast and loose with the deer, that maybe these pigeons are fake too, and they're manifestations of his madness. I don't think there's evidence that directly supports this.
Well, the guy says, Jesus fucking Christ, there are birds on the table. what about the bet? He's not seeing all of that happen.
Yeah, that's true.
That's actually happening.
That and well, but also Kevin did not, or did he? I thought at one point he actually did see a real deer, but the other two times he saw them were maybe intimated that it was in his head. I don't know. I need to go back and watch the first episode again.
The 2 or 3 week jump between episode 1 and 2 throws all that into confusion because you don't know, could he have repaired his car? Could he have repaired his kitchen? Like,
yeah.
That calls into question a lot of stuff.
You get a contractor in there to fix your kitchen in 3 weeks. I want to know his phone number. Benji said, just about every aspect of this episode reminded me of Lost. The music, the camera shots, lighting, the way it built tension, yeah. A million other little beats like the quick cut from the intense parking lot scrum to Love Will Keep Us Together, or even the way it was entirely focused on a seemingly peripheral character. Now I think the first 2 or 3 seasons of Lost are some of the best television ever, so this is all meant as a compliment. You're the Lost fan. I never made it past the first couple episodes of season 2. You think this is, is that valid? Is this a lot of Lindelof touches here?
Yeah, I mean, structurally, Lost is a slight bit different when it does these kind of pieces because it will typically use flashbacks. It will rely heavily on flashbacks. I mean, there's episodes like Walkabout with Locke where things are flashing back all the time and you're getting most of your narrative through that and you're seeing why they're reacting to their current situation because of those flashbacks and things that have happened in their history. So I feel like it's similar in some ways, but it doesn't rely on the flashbacks the same way that a Lost episode would. But other than that, yeah, I definitely, like I said before, I felt like this was Losty.
Balar Margulis says, there's been much made about how doom and gloom the show is, and this week's episode didn't do anything to change our perception. In fact, it almost made me point to a show, or made a point to show us that whatever forces are at work are firmly in the corner of the guilty remnant. However, one such person has been positively impacted by the event. Not one person has been positively impacted by the event. Imagine the relief of an abusive parent vanishing. Imagine there's an angle in which a man's nagging wife and snotty teenage child disappear, but he completely and secretly is static. What if someone took the opportunity to make it appear as if they were one of the 2% in order to avoid a terrible gambling debt?
Sure. No, I've brought that up before.
Surely this can't be only some rightfully so depressed souls wandering about the earth coping and hoping to just make it through the day, right?
You would think so, yeah. Like we talked about and like he brings up, the child abuser. The child's probably grateful that that's not happening to them anymore.
You know, I mean, and it would be not surprise me if they take Matt's sister, God damn it, what's her name?
Nora,
and if it turns out that she did murder her husband because she did know about him cheating.
Oh, boy.
Like they came home, and their children, and they're grieving, and she just decides, there's no reason for me to stay with you. Awesome.
Oh, boy. Okay.
Dave McBee, you don't like that? Or you...
No. It's just a little darker of a perception than I have of her. And when I say little, I mean significantly.
Well, that's what I'm here for, man. Dave McBee said, in an episode 3 with so much up in the air, is it too early for a series to go for a bottle episode? I understand that Eccleston might not have been available for a lot of shooting days, but don't we normally need to flesh out the storyline before we run with a bottle episode? I was about as interested in this episode as some of the Governor episodes of The Walking Dead last season. While this is still a good episode, unlike the Governor ones, I felt it was misplaced with someone that didn't particularly want to spend an hour with. Overall, I did like the growth of the character, but this should have been an episode 5 or 6 type episode. Do you agree with that criticism?
I'm borderline on this. I think if this leads to something necessary in episode 4, like we talked about earlier... kind of a bigger reveal for the guilty remnant, and that leads us into episode 5. Maybe this episode needed to happen when it happened in order to explain other things. So I'm willing to give them a little bit of leeway, but I do also think he's right. I feel like it killed some momentum coming out of episode 2.
Yeah.
And so maybe it was a little early for a bottle episode, but if they can, you know, push this into an awesome episode 4, maybe it actually works.
What if this has been episode 1?
Oof. Well, I don't think it works from the guilty remnant perspective, but...
Maybe. I don't know. They're still kind of as mysterious as they are. Doesn't work from his wife's perspective, being there out on the playground.
Yeah. Or Nora, really. Like, they would have to make it a different episode.
So yeah, okay, let's move on to JD. I went to watch the crash the priest had in the pilot episode, and the priest's wife actually pulled out into traffic and got hit by a car driven by the departed. The fact that the car had no driver is really irrelevant, since the wife pulled out in the oncoming traffic and would have been hit anyway. Basically, I'm saying the 14th had no influence on what happened to the priest's wife, just her poor driving skills.
There you go, man. That judge said that exact thing because he took bribe money.
This is a super, because we actually went back and watched. Yeah, and he's absolutely right. She pulls out into the road and then gets crammed by this guy. If she had watched, this wouldn't have happened. However, I get the implication that this is an intersection. Mm-hmm. Like, at just off camera, there's a building cuts us off, but it seems like there would be an intersection with maybe a traffic light. Maybe the light was red and she counted on the guy stopping and got plowed.
It's possible.
But we don't know that. It would be interesting if he is going on this campaign for faulty reasons. That guy could have, the BMW driver could have been manning the vehicle and still creamed her.
Yeah.
And that would be another ironic level as well. And maybe that's why the wife is cast as a famous person, because we're going to see that maybe their relationship wasn't all that great, and maybe he should have been the one driving the vehicle, and they had a fight, and, you know, there's all kinds of things. Because it is odd that his church was that stricken. I mean, there was like 6-7 people, not counting his vegetable wife and her caretaker that's paid to be there, that was at that church. I wonder if there's a little bit more to that as well.
Definitely could be. I feel like that's in large part due to his campaign, but I don't know yet.
Oh, that's true, because that's polarizing as hell.
I mean, now I see why people would punch you in the face. That's what the guy at the casino told him.
Right. Maybe that's why he had to start doing the papers, because he was saying that at the church and it drove people away.
Because
he said something about, she said, you should do that in your church. And he goes, that's not what this is. So, great feedback. Thanks a lot for giving it to us. You can give us more at leftovers@baldmove.com. You can participate on our live show and podcast thread at baldmove.com. Facebook.com/baldmove, and tweet at Jim @baldmove on Twitter. That's all I got, Jim.
All right, sounds good. We'll be back next Tuesday with another episode. Until then, I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron. See ya.